We are talking with Dean Baker. He is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Is the stock market a good indicator of what's happening in the economy?
No, I'd say two things about that. First off, the stock market day-to-day tells you almost nothing. And, you know, the best example of this, I have to say, I was amazed by the National Bureau of Economic Research, the agency that's given the responsibility for officially dating recessions, announced or pronounced that we had a recession. We were in a recession. And when they did that, the stock market fell by, I believe, it was 9% that day. And you sort of look at that and you go, you didn't realize, these folks didn't realize we had a recession? I mean, that'd be very scary, you know. So what caused that? Well, my guess is there wasn't that much economic news that came out that day, and, you know, some number of people said, oh, you know, they announced that's going to be a recession, that's going to be bad news for the stock market. So you got this big sell-off that, for practical purposes, was based on nothing. I mean, again, everyone knew we were in a recession. The committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research that dates it was at some point going to announce that. You know, when they would do that, I didn't know. When they would date it, I didn't know. But it's not really of any consequence. It didn't change anything about the economy. So should we get really worried that the stock market plunged that day? Well, if you had to sell your stock that day for some reason, I'd be worried. But you know, in terms of what it says about the economy, it meant nothing. So the day-to-day movements are best ignored. They don't mean anything, obviously, unless you're trying to trade on them. But the other part of the story, sort of the longer part of the story, the stock market in principle represents the future profits of corporate America. And those can go up because the economy's growing or expected to grow. And in that case, we could say, well, that's good news. You know, that stock market's going up because the economy's going to grow 10% over the next couple of years and corporate profits will go up 10%. So that's a good story. We could say we're all sort of benefiting from that, and good news, stock market's going up. But it could be a case the stock market's going up simply because wages are going down, or maybe we gave corporations a lot of big tax breaks, so the stock market sees that we just elect a conservative government that's committed itself to big tax breaks for corporate America. So stock market rises. Well, most of us won't benefit from those tax breaks. Most of us don't own a lot of stock. So what that means is that the services that the government otherwise would have provided, they either aren't going to be able to provide, or they're going to have to tax the rest of us because they're not taxing corporations. So in that case, the stock market's going up because corporate America is going to have more money, but the rest of us, it's coming at the expense of the rest of us. So it'd be kind of foolish for most of us who don't own much stock or no stock at all for almost half the country to be going out and celebrating that. That's not particularly good news. Now, the final story you could say with the stock market, of course, is sometimes it moves for no reason whatsoever. This is the irrational exuberance story that we had in the 90s stock bubble when stock prices bore no real relationship to corporate profits. They just got, you know, this giddiness that you had stocks go through the roof. It's hard to see how that benefits anyone except for people who are speculating in the bubble. So in that case, was it good news that you had the Dow Jones hitting record highs in 99 and 2000? I'd say not at all. You know, again, if you're speculating on it and being real smart about it and you can get out at the peak in March of 2000, well, good for you. But most people aren't in that boat. We would have been much better off if the stock market had never gone into that sort of bubble.
So who, when the nightly news talks about the market and the investors, who really are the investors in the market?
Well, you do have pension funds. You do have mutual funds. I mean, a lot of people do own a stake in that. But again, on a day-to-day basis, there's not really any reason. Most of these people are not selling. Their pension funds are not selling. So they have no particular reason to celebrate that. There is a relatively small group of very wealthy people that has a substantial interest in the stock market. And they certainly might celebrate that the stock market's gone up. But that's certainly not the vast majority of the population. I mean, again, the numbers here are really striking. Just over 50% of the public owns any stock at all, even including through mutual funds and retirement accounts, 401ks or IRAs. So just over 50% has any at all. And then of that group that owns stock, the median ownership, and this is using old data, the median stake was just 30,000. I'm saying that's old data because obviously the stock market's plummeted. So if you had 30,000 a year ago, you'd have 15 today or thereabouts. So I don't know what the number would be today, but certainly something less than 30,000, considerably less than 30,000. So what we could say is that 75% of the public has less than 30,000 in the stock market, including whatever they might have in a 401k or IRA. So most people do not have a big stake in the stock market.
Talk about the terminology that's often presented without any real explanation in the evening business report. Things like GDP and GNP, are those really legitimate terms for measuring what is happening within the economy and having a impact on people like you and I?
Well, it's a mixed story. GDP refers to gross domestic product, GNP, less often used these days, gross national product, which are supposed to measure the total value of goods and services produced. And other things equal, I'd say in general, if we see that growing, we're better off than it's shrinking. You know, typically, if the GDP is growing, we're creating jobs, presumably keeping the unemployment rate at least steady, if not actually falling. So in general, we're better off with a growing economy than a shrinking economy. But just because the economy is growing doesn't mean everyone's doing well. So a big part of the story over the last quarter century, really almost 30 years now, has been that most of the benefits from growth have gone to the people at the top of the income distribution. So the economy has been growing, and again, I'll rather grow than not grow. But if the benefits go almost all to the people on Wall Street, to doctors, lawyers, professionals, they don't go to a typical worker in a restaurant or a hotel or a custodian or an auto worker. If it's not going to them, then it's a mixed benefit. And, of course, there are a lot of things that aren't counted in GNP either, you know, their GDP. So we don't factor in pollution, you know, insofar as the economy is growing, but we're polluting a lot, polluting more. If that were the case, many people might be suffering from that pollution if we've wrecked lakes or wrecked the environment in other ways. A lot of people could be suffering from the growth that we're experiencing. So it doesn't mean that everyone necessarily benefits. Some people could be very seriously harmed. So in general, I would say it's a worthwhile measure. It's a good measure. And in general, I'd say we'd rather see a rising GDP than a falling one. But just because our economy is growing at a good rate doesn't mean that everyone's doing well by any means.
One of your areas of specialty is the copyright protection and patents. And I think that's something that touches everyone on a daily basis, at least economically, yet there's like zero coverage within the media. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, one of the stories that's really striking is copyrights and patents are clearly very, very big government interventions into the economy, but they're almost never talked about that way. I mean, if you think about what they are, they're quite literally government-guaranteed monopolies. So if I have a copyright on a new song I made or a book I wrote, that means that I could have the government arrest you if you make a copy of it without my permission. So it's a very, very strong intervention in the economy. And this has enormous significance for both areas, both copyright and patent. If you look at copyright, I mean, all the material music that we could in principle get costlessly over the internet, and obviously people do often get costlessly over the internet, but in principle you're supposed to pay whoever owns the copyright. We suddenly made it very expensive. In case of software, for example, you get all the software that you could pay Microsoft $200, $300, $400, sometimes much more for some types of software that in principle could be available free over the web. So it adds hugely to the cost. It makes enormous economic distortions. I would argue it's a very, very inefficient way, economically inefficient way, to produce sort of creative material, music, software for that matter, writing of different types. We do need to support creative workers, and I've thought of mechanisms, other mechanisms you could use to support the people who do the work. So the question isn't that I think musicians shouldn't get compensated. I think they should. The point is that we have better ways to do it than copyright. With patents, where I see the biggest problem is patents on prescription drugs, and it's just remarkable to me how little attention this has gotten. At this point, the country projected to spend $250 billion this year on prescription drugs. That's about 1.8% of GDP. It's a lot of money. And if you didn't have patent protection, we'd probably be talking about spending somewhere in the order of $25 billion. In other words, we'd probably be spending about one-tenth as much on prescription drugs. The whole story here is the reason drugs are expensive is because the drug companies have patent monopolies. Walmart now sells a lot of generic drugs for $4 a prescription. Well, the difference between the drug that they sell for $4 at Walmart and the branded drug that you could spend $300, $400, sometimes $1,000 on, it's not that those are more expensive to produce. It's simply that they have a monopoly. They have a patent monopoly. So what I've argued is that it's a really, really bad policy to fund research through patent monopolies. I mean, that's obviously the rationale, that Pfizer won't do the research if they couldn't charge you $500. I'd say we have much better routes. One route that I propose is simply have the government pay for the research directly. We already pay for close to half of biomedical research through the National Institutes of Health. We spend about $30 billion a year funding research, most of it more basic research at the National Institutes of Health. There's no reason in principle we couldn't double that funding and have that available through various mechanisms for doing the research of actually developing the drugs, bringing them through the clinical testing process, and then once that's done, having everything in the public domain so that all drugs could be sold at Walmart for $4 a prescription. So I think that would be a much better way to finance drug research. I think we'd get better drugs because right now the industry has enormous incentive basically to lie to us. They have enormous incentive to tell us that their drug is going to be great, it's going to cure our arthritis or whatever it might be, because they make so much money on it. They give them a really good incentive to mislead patients, and they do that. Whereas if you took the money out, they're selling it for $4, just like, you know, be sold as a normal product in a competitive market, just like if you're buying a chair or a table, they wouldn't have the same incentive to provide misleading information to the public. So I think we'd both get better health care because we'd know what these drugs do and don't do much better if we took the money out by getting rid of the patent monopolies. And on top of that, we'd save ourselves an enormous amount of money. We'd be buying drugs at $4 a prescription rather than $400.
It's interesting that it's just been in the last few years where they started having commercials on television for these different prescription drugs and basically turning people watching television into, you know, the person pushing the doctor for very specific items.
Yeah, this has been a new policy that, it was outlawed actually until fairly recently, but the drug companies realize they have this great potential for creating a market where they advertise to directly to consumers, patients, who aren't going to know anything about drug. They see, I remember they had one commercial with, I think it was Peggy Fleming, the ice skating medal winner from many, many years back. She's skating on ice and she's talking about this drug for arthritis. Now, we might see that, you know, maybe we know Peggy Fleming is and go, well, that's great. She's, you know, whatever age now and she's still skating. And then we go, oh, we should take this drug. Well, of course, that doesn't tell us anything about whether it's a good drug or bad drug. We're in no position to assess that. But we go to our doctor and we go, oh, yeah, we saw this commercial and what about this drug? And the doctor's thinking, sure, what do I care? You know, I'll make you happy. I'll write a prescription for it. So this is not the way to be prescribing medicine. I mean, the way to be prescribing medicine is doctors should make their decision based on the best available scientific evidence.
You've also written about people who are called detailers with the pharmaceutical industry?
Yeah, it's a great story. I mean, the industry employs tens of thousands of people. Detailers are, they go around from doctor's office to doctor's office, talking to doctors, giving out samples, pushing their drugs. And it's really a very pernicious enterprise. The New York Times had a great piece about this maybe 2 or 3 years ago where they talked about the people they hire, and apparently they actually seek out former cheerleaders for this job. And you know, what they say about, well, they're enthusiastic. They could be, you know, good sales representatives. They find that they're, well, presumably they're not, former cheerleaders don't have any special skills as in pharmacology. So, you know, they're appealing to these doctors based on being attractive people who could be effective pushing their drugs. Again, this is not the way we think doctors should prescribe medicine. I should also point out there's something really pernicious about this. I hadn't fully appreciated it. I have a friend who's a doctor, does a lot of research in this area, and he kept going on about the free samples. I'm like, well, what's wrong with that? They give out free samples. It's actually extremely pernicious because the idea is that, you know, you go in as a patient to your doctor, and let's say you have arthritis, and the doctor knows there's, you know, 8, 10, 20 arthritis drugs they could prescribe. And they go, well, but I have these free samples here. Why don't I give you the free samples? Well, maybe the free samples, the drug that they have the free samples of, are not the best drug, but they're there, they're easiest, they'll make the patient happy. Well, if that works, if that seems to work, you're going to continue to take it because the doctor's not going to switch you away from a drug that seems to work for the moment. So they get an enormous value here from inertia. Now, maybe that's okay if the drug isn't causing you any great harmful side effects and it more or less treats you well, but it may well be the case that this isn't the best drug for you. Maybe one of the other drugs would be better, but you aren't going to know that because you're using this and, you know, the inertia. You're using that and you'll stay with it. And then, of course, odds are this drug is much more expensive. There might be a generic drug that may be a tenth the price, but you're on this brand drug and you're going to stay on it. So it actually is a very, very pernicious practice. And again, we want doctors to be picking the best drug based on the available evidence, not based on the fact that some former cheerleaders come through the door and the doctor finds him or her attractive and hands out a free sample and therefore prescribes it. So it's not the way we should be making decisions on prescribing drugs.
My understanding was that used to be an old trick with illicit drug dealers, give out the first sample free and get the people hooked.
Not the ones I knew, but...
That also seems to be popping up on the television commercials as well, that you can get free samples in a lot of these drugs.
Absolutely. And again, it's, you know, it's very much a strategy. Get people, in effect, hooked. Get them on there. Take advantage of the power of inertia. Because again, it's, you know, from the standpoint of someone actually being on the drug, I'd be very sympathetic to the doctor saying, well, that seems to be working, particularly when you keep in mind much of the drug use is by older patients that have multiple conditions. So someone's taking drug X and doesn't seem to be having any big problem with it, more or less does what they're supposed to be doing, then you're going to say, well, stay on drug X. So, again, in the best-case scenario, maybe drug X is no worse than the other drugs, so you're just spending more money. It's a waste of money for the system. But in many cases, drug X may not be the best drug, but you won't ever find out what the best drug is because you start with drug X and you're going to stay with drug X.
It's also disturbing from the standpoint of that most drugs are never tested for drug interactions, you know, with multiple drugs. Somebody popping 5 different samples of God knows what, they don't know what's going to happen later.
Well, that's right, and that's again one of the advantages that we could have from going away from the system of patent-supported research, because obviously if you're looking to get a patent, you have to have secrecy because you want to get the patent, you want to get all the information, take advantage of it before your competitors can. So you basically disclose the information you need to get the patent, you disclose the information you need to get the Food and Drug Administration to approve your drug. You don't make all your information publicly available. On the other hand, if we said, okay, we're going to have a system of publicly financed drug research, including the clinical trials, and the condition of getting this money, either directly or indirectly, is that everything you do is in the public domain. So not just when you get the patent, is the patent in the public domain, but if you do a clinical trial and you have 5,000 people in your trial, well, we want all that information in the public domain. So when you get your 5,000 people in your trial, you're telling us how old is each person, you know, do they have a weight problem, do they have arthritis, are they taking other drugs, and you're going to put up on the web all the information, how each person did, and that will allow other researchers to go back and go, oh, okay, your drug was good on average, but how did it do for young people? How did it do for people who had a weight problem? How did it do for people who were taking arthritis medications? How did it do for people who were taking heart medications? People could do that. You would get all this additional information that would allow researchers, allow doctors to make a much more informed judgment as to what is the best drug. As it stands now, the information that you get is what the drug company chooses to give. So, okay, the drug was more effective than a placebo in treating people. That's good news. We can know that. But that doesn't tell you whether it's the best drug to give to this or that person, given their set of medical conditions.
It's interesting, too, that in addition to the public not having access to a lot of the data that these drug companies come out with from their trials, that the participants themselves don't ever get to see the data.
That's right. I mean, they're kind of treated as sheep, that they're told, okay, take the drug. And, I mean, some of this, they can't know whether they're in the placebo or control group or would defeat or treatment group or that would defeat the purpose of the study. But they very often have very little idea what the purpose of the trial is and what ends up happening.
In addition, I just saw in some documents I FOIA'd myself, unrelated to this, that they're pushing for within the contracts that patients sign when they participate in these drug trials that their DNA can go into multiple databases, including like the Human Genome Project, that can be used by these different organizations later on. They have no control over that once they sign these contracts.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard of that, but it wouldn't surprise me. You know, again, it's the sort of thing. It would make sense that we would have this done public, that we have this done through the government and have public control over that, that we could use it for purposes that are considered appropriate, but just not for the convenience of the drug companies.
So if the government did this, they would hire third-party companies to do the testing?
That would be how I would envision it. I would envision something like you'd in effect have master contracts. You want to have competition, take advantage of that, take advantage of the private sector. No reason it can't be done through the private sector. A model here might be building airports that, you know, are major construction projects like that, where typically the government will sign a certain number of master contracts and they're going to subcontract with different people to do different jobs. Now, rules that apply to the master contract apply to all the subcontractors. So in this case, the key rule is that everything's public. And that should minimize the opportunities for abuse, for corruption, because everything's up there on the web, so we could see it. And also, again, everyone could take advantage of the results. And the key, the other part of the story is to say, I want to see competition, so it's not a question of, you know, getting rid of competition, getting rid of the private sector, it's just how does the private sector act. So I think, we could have government put up the money, have master contracts competed out. And I know I've argued with people and they say, oh, so you want it to be inefficient like, you know, airport contracts, and go, yeah, that's fine, because there is inefficiency, no doubt about it. There is no perfect system. But the inefficiencies associated with building the airports, we usually do get the airport. That's very small compared to the inefficiencies of the current system of financing prescription drug research.
And finally, I wanted to get back to you had mentioned that you have some proposals as solutions for the copyright question.
Yeah, what I've proposed is, I gave it the term the artistic freedom voucher, that we would give every person in the country some amount of money, let's say $100, $150, you could argue over the sum you'd want, to contribute to supporting creative artistic work. And they could either give it directly to an individual or give it to an organization, that an intermediary that might then distribute it to individuals. So maybe I like blues music, so I could take my $100 and give it to the Blues Music Association, which will then give the money to blues musicians. And the condition of getting the money is that everything you produce is in the public domain. You can't get a copyright on it. So everything you produce has to be freely available. And what's nice about this story, it requires very little bureaucracy. It's actually not all that different from what we have today with nonprofit organizations getting tax exempt status. That I don't have to go to the IRS and go, my think tank has tax exempt status. I don't have to go to the IRS and go, we do really good work, look it over. All I have to do is be prepared to tell the IRS, here's what we do, we qualified it for tax exempt status. And the only thing the IRS does is validate that, in fact, we're a think tank. We're not, doing vacations to the Caribbean, So as long as I'm a blues musician, I go, here's the blues music. They don't have to decide it's good music or bad blues music. The people who contribute to me will decide that. And it's self-enforcing in the sense that suppose I tried to cheat. Suppose I tried to say, oh, I just got paid $500,000 through Blues Music Association, but I'm a real smart guy and I make great music, so I'm going to get copyright anyhow, and then try and sell it and make lots of money. Well, my copyright's unenforceable because it's registered that Dean Baker was getting money through this system. So anyone go, oh, well, that's wonderful. Who cares if it has a copyright? I'm going to make copies and distribute all over because I could do that because he got money through the system. And I might get real upset, but I can't do anything. I can't have my copyright enforced. So it creates a system that creates a vast amount of creative artistic work that would all be available for free. And it doesn't even take away copyright from anyone, because if I want to get my copyright, the answer is don't take the money. So we could just let it compete with the existing copyright system. And if people would rather go to Disney or Time Warner and get their stuff, go ahead and pay for it. But there'll be this vast amount of music, movies, whatever it might be, that's available completely free over the Internet.
We are talking with Dean Baker. He is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And, Dean, can people, if they want to find out more about some of the ideas you've proposed, can they find out more via your website?
Yeah, people can go to our website at www.cepr.net. Again, that's www.cepr.net. I also should say my book, The Conservative Nanny State, is available, can be available for free download on the web at www.conservativenannystate.org.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Again, just talking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and you can find out more via their website, cepr.net, and his website, conservativenannystate.org.